lot of attention. Doris is watching these mating rituals. She's seen it all before. She says, "Brad's parents are quite upset." I jump in with, "Then I'll be happy to talk to them, to apologize, and to have Starcher apologize too. How about that?"
"I'll handle this," Judith barks.
"Then why did you invite me to this little party?" "I'll tell you why. You want to make sure all blame is properly laid at my feet. 5 days ago, I took the kid to the cage fights. Now he's brawling on the playground. Clear proof it's all my fault. You win. You wanted some witnesses. So here we are. Do you feel better now?" This, of course, sucks the air out of the room. Judith's eyes glaze over with hatred, and I can almost see steam coming out of her ears. Doris, the pro, rushes in with, "Okay, okay, I like the idea of one of you having a chat with Brad's parents." "One of the two of us, or one of the three of us?" I ask. What a smartass. "I'm sorry, but it gets kind of crowded." Ava shoots daggers at me. I glance at the teacher's legs. What a ridiculous meeting. Doris shows some spine by looking at me and saying, "I think you should do it. You're right. It's a boy thing. Call Brad's parents and apologize." "Done."
"What's the punishment for Starcher?" Ava asks, because Judith can't speak right now.
Doris says,
"What do you think, Miss Tarrant?"
"Well, there has to be a punishment."
I make matters worse by saying, "Don't tell me you're going to expel the kid." Miss Tarrant says,
"No, he and Brad are friends, and I think they've already moved on. What about a week with no recess?"
"Can he still have lunch?" I ask, just trying to clog the wheels of justice. I'm a lawyer. It's instinctive. She smiles but ignores this. We hammer out an agreement, and I'm the first one to leave. As I drive away from the parking lot, I realize I'm smiling. Starcher stood his ground. Late that night, I email Ms. Tarrant. Naomi is her first name, and thank her for doing such a fine job. 10 minutes later, she emails me back and says thanks. I fire right back and ask her to dinner. 20 minutes later, she informs me it's not a good idea to date parents of her kids. In other words, not now, maybe in the future. It's Wednesday and raining. We've played dirty golf many times in bad weather, but Alan said no tonight. No more ruts in the fairways. Old Rico is closed for the evening. I'm wide awake, bored, worried about Tadeo and Doug Renfro, and I'm also fairly revved up at the slim prospects of chasing Ms. Tarrant. Sleep eludes me again, so I grab an umbrella and hustle down to the rack. At midnight, I'm losing $10 a game in 9-ball to a kid who looks no more than 15. I ask him if he goes to school, to which he answered,
"Occasionally."
Curly is watching us, and at one point whispers to me,
"Never seen him before. Amazing."
Mercifully, Curly closes the place at 1 a.m. The kid has picked my pockets for $90. I'll avoid him next time. At 2, I manage to close my eyes and fall asleep. Chapter 14. Partner calls me at 4. Sean King died of a cerebral hemorrhage. I make coffee and drink it in the dark while gazing down on the city, still and quiet at this hour. The moon is full, and its light reflects off the tall buildings downtown. What a tragedy. Tadeo Zapata will now spend at least the next decade or so behind bars. He's 22, so he'll be too old to fight when he gets out. Too old for many things. I think about the money, but just for a minute. I invested $30,000 in the kid for a quarter share of his career earnings, which to date total about $80,000. Plus, I've picked up another $20,000 betting on him. So I'm slightly ahead on the cash side. I try not to think about his future earnings, which were going to be substantial. All that seems trivial now. Instead, I think about his family, their hard life, and the hope he gave them. He was their ticket out of the street life and the violence to the middle class and beyond. Now they'll sink even deeper into poverty while he rots away in prison. There is no defense, no credible legal strategy to save him.
I've watched the video 100 times now. The last flurry of blows to Sean King's face were absorbed while he was unconscious. It won't be difficult to find an expert who'll say those were the shots that did the fatal damage. But an expert will not be needed. This case is not going to trial. I'll serve my client well if I can somehow pressure the state to make us a decent offer. I just hope it's 10 years and not 30, but something tells me I'm dreaming. No prosecutor in this country would pass up the opportunity to nail such a high-profile murderer. I force myself to think about Sean King, but I never knew the guy. I'm sure his family is devastated and all that, but my thoughts return to Dedeo. At 6, I shower, get dressed, and head for the jail. I have to tell Tadeo that his life as he knew it is over. Chapter 15. The following Monday, Tadeo Zapata and I appear in court again, though the mood is quite different. He's charged with murder now, and thanks to the internet, he's famous. It seems as though few people can resist the temptation of watching him kill Sean King with his bare hands. As expected, the judge denies bail, and they take Tadeo away. I've had 2 brief chats with the prosecutor, and it looks like they're out for blood. Second-degree murder carries a max of 30 years. For a plea, they'll agree to 20. Under our screwed-up parole system, he'll serve at least 10. I have yet to explain this to my client. He's still in denial, still in that fog where he's sorry it happened, can't explain it, but still believing that a good lawyer can pull some strings and get him off. It's a sad day, but not a complete waste. In the large open hallway outside the courtroom, there is a crowd of reporters and they're waiting for me. There is no gag order yet, so I'm free to say all the ridiculous things that lawyers say long before the trials. My client is a good person who snapped when he got a raw deal. Now he is devastated by what happened. He cries in sympathy for the family of Sean King. He would give anything to have those few precious seconds back. We will mount a vigorous defense. Yes, of course, he hopes to fight again. He was helping his poor mother support her family and a houseful of relatives. And so on. Chapter 16. With Harry and Harry churning out the paperwork, and with Judge Sampson haranguing the city's lawyers whenever they get close to his courtroom, the civil action moved ahead at an unusually rapid pace. We are in a race here, one that we will not win. I would love to try Doug Renfro's civil case in a packed courtroom before his criminal case is called. The problem is that we have a speedy trial rule in criminal cases, but not in civil. In theory, a criminal case must be brought to trial or otherwise disposed of within 120 days of indictment, though this is routinely waived by the defendant's lawyer because more time is needed to prepare. There is no such rule in civil cases, which often drag on for years. In my perfect scenario, we would try the civil case first, get a huge verdict that would be front-page news and, more important, influence prospective jurors in the criminal case. The press can't get enough of the Renfro debacle, and I relish the chance to grill the cops on the witness stand for the benefit of the entire city. If the criminal prosecution goes first, and if Doug Renfro is convicted, then the civil case will be much more difficult to win. As a witness, he'll be impeachable because of his conviction. Judge Sampson understands this and is trying to help. Less than 3 months after the botched SWAT raid, he orders all 8 cops to appear in his chambers to be deposed by me. No judge, federal or otherwise, would ever consider suffering through a single deposition. It would be far beneath his or her dignity. But to set the mood and deliver the message to the cops and their lawyers that he is highly suspicious of them, Judge Sampson orders the depositions to be taken on his turf, with his law clerk and his magistrate in the room. It is a brutal marathon that pushes me to the limits. I begin with Lieutenant Chip Summerall, the leader of the SWAT team. I elicit testimony regarding his experience, training, and participation in other home invasions. I am deliberately dull, tedious, poker-faced. It's just a deposition, the purpose of which is to establish sworn testimony. Using maps, photos, and videos, we walk through the Renfro affair for hours. It takes 6 full days to depose the 8 cops. But they're on the record now, and they cannot change their stories at either the criminal or the civil trials. Chapter 17. The only time I spend in domestic relations court is when I'm dragged in to account for my sins. I wouldn't handle a divorce or adoption at gunpoint. Judith, though, makes her living in the gutter warfare of divorce trials, and this is her turf. His honor today is one Stanley Leaf, a cranky old veteran who lost interest years ago. Judith represents herself, as do I. For the occasion, she's dragged in Ava, who sits as the lone spectator, in a skirt so short you can see her name and address. I catch Judge Leaf gazing at her, enjoying the scenery. Since we're both lawyers and representing ourselves, Judge Leaf dispenses with the formalities and allows us to just sit and talk, as if we're in arbitration. We are on the record, though, and a stenographer is taking it all down. Judith goes first, states the facts, and makes it sound as though I'm the worst parent in history because I took my son to the cage fights. Then, 4 days later, Starcher got in his first fight at school. Clear proof that I've turned him into a monster. Judge Lee frowns, as if this is just awful. With as much drama as she can muster, Judith proclaims that all visitation rights should be terminated so the kid will never again be subjected to my influence. Judge Leaf shoots me a quick glance that says, "Is she crazy?" But we're not here for justice. We're here for a show. Judith is an angry mother, and she's once again dragged me into court. My punishment is not the loss of visitation rights. Rather, it's just the hassle of dealing with her. She will not be pushed around. She will protect her child at all costs. From my seat, I tell my side of the story without embellishing a single word. She produces a copy of the newspaper with her son on the front page. What humiliation! He could have been seriously injured. Judge Leaf is almost asleep. She produces an expert, a child psychologist. Dr. Salabar, female, of course, informs the court that she has interviewed Starcher, spent an entire hour with him, talked about the cage fights and the playground brawl, and is now of the opinion that the carnage he witnessed while under my supervision had a detrimental effect on him and encouraged him to start a fight of his own. Judith manages to string this testimony out until Judge Leaf is practically comatose. On cross-examination, I ask, "Are you married?"
"Yes."
"Do you have a son or sons?"
"2 boys, yes."
"Did you ever take either son to boxing matches, wrestling matches, or cage fights?"
"No."
"Did either son ever get into a fight with another kid?"
"Well, I'm sure they did, but then I really can't say."
The fact that she won't answer the question speaks volumes. Judge Leaf shakes his head. "Did your boys ever get into a fight with one another?"
"I don't recall."
"You don't recall? Were you a loving mother who gave your sons all the attention possible?"
"I'd like to think so."
"So you were there for them?"
"As much as possible, yes."
"And you can't remember a single time when one of them got into a fight?"
"Well, no, not at this time."
"What about some other time?" "Strike that. Nothing further." I glance at the judge, and he's frustrated. But things brighten up considerably when the next witness takes the stand. It's Naomi Tarrant, Starcher's teacher, and she's wearing a tight dress and stilettos. By the time she promises to tell the truth, old Judge Leaf is wide awake. So am I. School teachers hate to get dragged into custody and visitation battles. Naomi is no exception, though she knows how to handle this situation. We've been swapping emails for a month now. She still won't agree to dinner, but I'm making progress. She testifies that Starcher had never shown any violent tendencies until a few days after his first trip to the cage fights. She describes the playground incident without referring to it as a fight or a brawl, just a couple of boys who had a misunderstanding. Judith calls her as a witness not to help in her search for the truth, but to show Naomi, as well as everyone else, that she has the power to drag them into court and bully them. On Cross, I get Naomi to admit that sooner or later, almost every normal boy she has ever taught has been involved in some type of scuffle on the playground. She's on and off the witness stand in 15 minutes, and when Judge Leaf dismisses her, he looks a bit disappointed. In closing, Judith repeats what's already been said and makes a strident plea to terminate all visitation rights. Judge Leaf stops her cold with, "But the father is getting only 36 hours a month. That's not very much." "Thank you," I say. "That's enough," Judith scolds me. "Sorry." The judge looks at me and asks, "Mr. Rudd, will you agree to keep the child away from cage fighting as well as boxing and wrestling matches?" "Yes, I promise." "And will you also agree to teach the child that fighting is a bad way to settle disputes?" "Yes, I promise." He glares at Judith and says, "Your petition is denied. Anything else?" Judith hesitates for a second, then says, "Well, I'll just have to appeal." "You have that right," he says as he taps his gavel. "This hearing is over." Chapter 18. The criminal trial of Doug Renfro begins on a Monday morning, and the courtroom is packed with potential jurors. As they are processed and seated by the courtroom bailiffs, the lawyers meet in the chambers of the Honorable Ryan Ponder, a 10-year veteran of our circuit courts and one of our better presiding judges. As always, on the first day of a significant trial, the mood is tense. Everyone is on edge. The lawyers look as though they haven't slept all weekend. We sit around a large table and cover some preliminary matters. As we wrap things up, Judge Ponder looks at me and says, "I want to get this straight, Mr. Rudd. The state is offering a deal whereby your client pleads guilty to a lesser charge, a ramped-up misdemeanor, and gets no jail time. He walks, and in return he agrees to drop his civil suit against the city and all of the other defendants. Correct?"
"That's correct, sir."
"And he is saying no to this deal?"
"Correct."
"Let's get this on the record." Doug Renfro is retrieved from a witness room and led into the judge's chambers. He is wearing a dark wool suit, white shirt, dark tie, and is dressed better than anyone in the room, with the possible exception of me. He stands tall, erect, and proud, an old soldier itching for a fight. It has been 10 months since his home was invaded by the police, and though he has aged considerably, his wounds have healed and he carries himself with confidence. Judge Ponder swears him to tell the truth. He says, "Now, Mr. Renfro, the state is offering you a deal, a plea agreement. It is in writing. Have you read it and discussed it with your lawyer?"
"I have, yes, sir."
"And do you realize that if you take this plea agreement, you will avoid this trial, walk out of here a free man, and never worry about going to prison?"
"Yes, I understand that. But I will not plead guilty to anything. The police broke into my home and killed my wife. They will not be charged, and that is wrong. I'll take my chances with the jury."
He glares at the prosecutor, gives him a look of disgust, and returns his gaze to Judge Ponder. The prosecutor, a veteran named Chuck Finney, hides his face behind some paperwork. Finney is not a bad guy and does not want to be where he is now sitting. His problem is simple and obvious. An eager beaver cop got wounded in a botched raid, and the law, in black and white, says the guy who shot him is guilty. It's a bad law, written by clueless people, and now Finney is compelled to enforce it. He cannot simply drop the charges. The police union is breathing down his neck. A word here about Max Mancini. Max is the city's chief prosecutor, appointed by the mayor and approved by the city council. He's loud, flamboyant, ambitious, a driven man who's going places, though it's not clear exactly where. He loves cameras as much as I do and will knock folks out of the way to get in front of one. He's crafty in the courtroom and boasts of a 99% conviction rate, same as every other prosecutor in America. Because he's the boss, he gets to manipulate the numbers, so he has real proof that his 99% is legitimate. Normally, in a case as big as Doug Renfro's, with front-page coverage guaranteed and live-action shots morning, noon, and night, Max would be dressed in his finest and hogging the spotlight. However, this case is dangerous, and Max knows it. Everybody knows it. The cops were wrong. The Renfro's are victims. A guilty verdict seems unlikely, and if there's one thing Max Mancini cannot risk, it's the wrong verdict. So, he's hiding. Not a peep out of our chief prosecutor. I'm sure he's lurking around somewhere in the shadows, gawking at all the cameras and dying inside, but Max will not be seen during this trial. Instead, he dumped it on Chuck Finney. Chapter 19. It takes 3 days to pick a jury, and it's clear that all 12 know a lot about the case. I have wrestled with the strategy of requesting a change of venue, but decided against it. There are a couple of reasons for this, one legitimate and the other based on pure ego. The first is that many people in this city are fed up with the cops and their brutal tactics. The second is that there are reporters and cameras everywhere, and this is my turf. Most important, though, my client prefers to be tried by a jury of his fellow citizens. In a crowded courtroom, Judge Ponder says, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we will now begin this trial with the opening statements. First, the state's attorney, Mr. Finney, then the defense, Mr. Rudd. I caution you that nothing you're about to hear is actually evidence. The evidence comes from only one source, and that's this witness chair right here. Mr. Finney." The prosecutor rises solemnly from his seat at the table, a table filled with deputy prosecutors and useless assistants. It's a show of legal muscle, an attempt to impress the jury with the gravity of the case against Mr. Renfro. I have a different strategy. Doug and I sit alone, just the two of us. Two little guys facing the depthless resources of the government. The defense table seems almost deserted when compared to the army across the aisle. I live for this David versus Goliath image. Chuck Finney is fiercely dull, and he begins with a grave, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is a tragic case." "No kidding, Chuck. Is that the best you can do?" Finney may not have his heart in this case, but he's not about to roll over. There are too many people watching, too much at stake. Now that the opening bell has sounded, the game is on. And the game is not about justice. From this point forward, it's all about winning. He does a fair job of describing the dangers of police work, especially in this day and age of assault weapons, sophisticated criminals, drug gangs, and terrorists. Today's policemen are often targets, victims of extremely violent thugs who have no respect for authority. There's a war out there, a war on drugs, a war on terror, a war on pretty much everything, and our brave law enforcement officers have every right to arm themselves to the hilt. That's why the smart people we elect to make our laws decided 6 years ago to make it a crime for a person, yes, even a homeowner, to fire upon our police when they are simply doing their jobs. That's why Doug Renfro is guilty as a matter of law. He fired upon our police, and he wounded Officer Scott Kiesler, a veteran who was just doing his job. Finney is striking the right chords and scoring some points here. A couple of the jurors glance disapprovingly at my client. After all, he did shoot a cop. But Finney is careful. The facts are not in his favor, regardless of what the law says. He is concise, to the point, and sits down after only 10 minutes, a record for a prosecutor. Judge Ponder says, "Mr. Rudd, for the defense." As a criminal defense lawyer, I rarely have the facts in my favor, but when I do, I find it impossible to be subtle. Hit them fast and hard and watch them scramble. I have believed since day one that I can win this case with the opening statement. I toss my legal pad on the podium and look at the jurors. Eye contact with every one of them. I begin. "First, they shot his dog, Spike, a 12-year-old yellow lab who was fast asleep on his bed in the kitchen. What did Spike do to deserve getting killed?
Nothing. He was just in the right place at the wrong time.
Why would they kill Spike?
They will attempt to answer this question with one of their standard lies. They will tell you that Spike threatened them, same as every other dog they kill when they invade private homes in the middle of the night. In the last 5 years, ladies and gentlemen, our gallant SWAT boys have killed at least 30 innocent dogs in this city, from old mutts to young puppies, all of whom were just minding their own business. Behind me, Chuck Finney stands and says,
"Objection, Your Honor. Relevancy. Not sure why the other SWAT maneuvers are relevant to this case."
I turn to the judge, and before he can rule, I say,
"Oh, it's relevant, Your Honor. Let's allow the jury to hear exactly how these raids go down. We will prove that these cops are trigger-happy and ready to shoot anything that moves."
Judge Ponder raises a hand and says,
"That's enough, Mr. Rudd. I'll overrule the objection. It's just an opening statement and not evidence."
True, but the jurors have already heard me. I return to them and say, "Spike didn't have a chance. The SWAT team kicked in the front and back door simultaneously, and 8 heavily armed warrior cops raced into the Renfro home. By the time Spike could get to his feet and bark, he was dead, blown away by 3 bullets from a semi-automatic handgun, the same kind used by Army Rangers. And the killing had just begun."
I pause and look at the jurors, some of whom are no doubt more distressed over the dead dog than anything else that happened that night.
8 cops, 8 SWAT team members, all equipped with more gear and armor than any American soldier who fought in Vietnam or World War II. Bulletproof vests, night vision goggles, highly sophisticated weapons, even black face paint to add a little drama.
But why? Why were they there?
I'm pacing now, back and forth in front of the jury box. I glance at the spectators. The place is packed, and I see the chief of police in the front row, hating me. Their usual routine in any case involving the police is to line up about 2 dozen uniformed cops on the front rows, where they sit with folded arms and glare at the jurors. Judge Ponder, though, would have none of it. I filed a motion to keep cops in uniforms out of the courtroom, and he agreed. The 8 SWAT boys are being kept in witness rooms and missing the fun. This disaster began with the boy next door, a troubled kid named Lance, 19 years old and going nowhere. Lance was rightfully unemployed, but not altogether unproductive. He made good money selling illegal narcotics, primarily the drug ecstasy. He was too smart to work the streets, so Lance used the internet. But not the internet we know. Lance lived in the murky and forbidden world of the dark web, a place where Google and Yahoo and the other great search engines do not go. Lance had been buying and selling drugs on the dark web for 2 years when he realized the Renfros had an unsecured wireless router. For a clever boy like Lance, it was easy to piggyback. For a year, Lance bought and sold ecstasy using the Renfro's wireless system, and of course, they didn't have a clue. This case, though, is not about drug trafficking, so don't be deceived. It's about a gargantuan screw-up by our police department. The state investigators were rounding up online drug dealers and came across the Renfro's IP address. With no other evidence and no real investigation, they launched a sting. They got 2 warrants, an arrest warrant for Doug Renfro and a search warrant for his home. I pause here and get a drink of water. I have never felt such stillness in a courtroom. All eyes are on me. All ears are listening. I return to the jury box and lean on the podium, as if I'm having a friendly chat with my grandfather. Now, back in the old days and not too long ago, back when police work was done by cops who knew their beat and knew how to handle criminals, back when the police knew they were police and not Navy SEALs, back then, ladies and gentlemen, an arrest warrant would be served by a couple of officers who would drive over to Mr. Renfro's home at a decent hour, ring his doorbell, step inside his house, and tell him he was under arrest. They would handcuff him and take him away, and do so with a great deal of professionalism.
Another pair of officers would show up with the search warrant and get Mr. Renfro's computer. Within a couple of hours, the police would realize their mistake. They would apologize profusely to Mr. Renfro and take him home. Then they would solve their crime. Compare then with now. Now, at least in this city, with its current leadership, the police launch surprise attacks on unsuspecting and law-abiding citizens in the middle of the night. And they shoot them and their dogs, and when they realize they have the wrong house, they lie and cover up. Another long pause as I step behind the podium, glance at some notes I don't need, and return my gaze to the jurors. If any of them are breathing, I can't tell it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a bad law in this state that says that a homeowner, one like Doug Renfro, who fires upon an officer of the law, even if the cop is at the wrong house, is automatically guilty. So why bother with this trial? Why doesn't someone simply read the statute and tell Mr. Renfro to go to prison for the next 40 years? Well, because there is no such thing as automatic guilt. That's why we have juries, and your job will be to decide if Doug Renfro knew what he was doing. Did he know the police were in his house? When he scrambled into the hallway and saw figures moving in the darkness, what was he thinking? I'll tell you. He was terrified. He was convinced some dangerous criminals had broken in and began shooting. And most important, he did not know they were police officers. If he didn't know, then he cannot be found guilty. They couldn't be police officers, could they? Why would the cops come to his house when he'd done nothing wrong? Why would they show up at 3 in the morning when everyone was sound asleep? Why didn't they knock on the door or ring the bell? Why did they kick in the front door and the back? Why? 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 Policemen don't behave in such an outrageous manner. Or do they? Chapter 20. The first witness is a big shot from the state police. Ruskin is his name, and he is put on the stand to begin the impossible task of justifying what the police were doing the night they raided the Renfro's home. With Finney serving up direct questions that have been so overly rehearsed they have no spontaneity, they plow through the insidious rise of drug trafficking on the Internet, the distressing rise in the number of teenagers who buy and sell there, and so on. I'm on my feet constantly with, "Your Honor, I object on the grounds of relevancy. What does this testimony have to do with Doug Renfro?" After Judge Ponder overrules me 3 times, he begins to get frustrated. Finney senses this and moves on. They walk through a tedious narrative in an attempt to explain how the state police set up an internet scam to catch drug dealers. All in all, it was fairly successful. They caught about 40 people in our state. Aren't they smart cops? "Did you kill anybody else?" is my first question, fired from my seat as I jump into what will be a contentious cross-examination. I ask Ruskin about the other arrests. Were SWAT teams used to serve warrants? Were there home invasions at 3 in the morning? Did anyone else lose a dog? Did you send in the tanks? Halfway through my cross-examination, I force him to admit what the world has known for months. They got the wrong house. His reluctance to admit it, though, damages his credibility. In 2 hours, I reduce Ruskin to a babbling fool, one who can't wait to get off the witness stand. I am often a sanctimonious asshole when my clients are dead guilty. Give me an innocent man, though, and I reek of arrogance and superiority. I realize this and struggle mightily to give the impression, to the jury anyway, that I am actually likable. I don't really care if they hate me, as long as they don't hate my client. But when representing a saint like Doug Renfro, it's imperative that I come across as zealous but not offensive, incredulous at the injustice, but also trustworthy. Their next witness is Chip Summerall, the leader of the invasion, a lieutenant on the force. He's brought in from a witness room and sworn to tell the truth.
As always, he's wearing his uniform with as many patches and medals as possible. Full uniform and regalia and finery, but minus his service revolver and handcuffs. He's a cocky ass with a strut, thick arms, and a crew cut. We had words during his deposition, and I glare at him as if he's already lying. Finney walks him through their narrative. They dwell on his extensive training and experience, his glorious record. They walk methodically through the timeline of the Renfro episode. He passes the buck as best he can, saying more than once that he was just following orders. I get a sense the entire courtroom is waiting for me to annihilate him on cross, and I struggle to control myself. I begin by commenting on his uniform, how nice and professional it is. How often does he wear it? What do some of the medals signify? Then I ask him to describe the uniform he was wearing the night he kicked in the door of the Renfro home. Layer by layer, article by article, weapon by weapon, from his steel-toed jackboots to his panzer-style combat helmet, we go through every bit of it. I ask him about his submachine gun, a Heckler & Koch MP5, designed for close combat and the finest in the world, he says proudly. I ask him if he used it that night, and he says he did. I grill him on whether he fired the shots that killed Kitty Renfro, and he claims he doesn't know. It was dark, and things happened fast. Bullets were flying. The police were taking fire. As I walk around the courtroom, I glance at Doug. His face is in his hands as he relives the nightmare. I glance at the jurors. Some are in disbelief. You say it was dark, officer, but you were outfitted with night vision glasses, weren't you?
Yes.
He's been well coached and keeps his answers as short as possible. And these are designed to allow officers to see in the dark, right?
Yes.
Okay, then why couldn't you see in the dark? The answer is obvious. He squirms a bit, but he's a tough one. He tries to evade with,
"Well, again, it all happened so fast. Before I could focus, shots were fired, and we just responded.
And you couldn't see Kitty Renfro at the end of the hallway, 30 feet away, in her white pajamas?"
"I didn't see her, no."
I badger him relentlessly on what he saw or should have seen. When I've scored every point possible on this, I jump back to the issue of police procedure. Who authorized the SWAT mission? Who was in the room when the decision was made? Did he or anyone else have the common sense to say perhaps such a mission was not necessary? Why did you wait until 3 in the morning to go in, when it was dark? What led you to believe Doug Renfro was such a dangerous man? He starts to crack, to lose his cool. He looks to Finney for help, but there's nothing he can do. He glances at the jury and sees nothing but suspicion. I grind away and expose the idiocy of their procedures. We talk about their training and their equipment. I even managed to bring the tank into the proceedings, and Judge Ponder allows me to show the jury an enlarged photo of it. The real fun begins when I'm allowed to explore other botched raids. Summerall has been suspended on 2 prior occasions for excessive force, and I walk him through those episodes. At times, his face gets red. At other times, he's sweating. Finally, at 6 p.m., after Summerall has spent 4 grueling hours on the stand, Judge Ponder asks me if I'm almost finished. "No, sir, just getting started," I say, real chipper, glaring at Summerall. I'm so pumped I could go until midnight.
"Very well, then. We'll stand in recess until 9 in the morning.
Chapter 21. At 9 sharp on Friday morning, the jurors are led in and welcomed by Judge Ponder. Officer Summerall is called and takes the stand again. Some of his cockiness is gone, but not all of it.
"Please continue your cross-examination, Mr. Rudd," Ponder says.
With the assistance of a clerk, I unfold and mount a large diagram of the Renfro home, both first and second floors. I ask Summerall, as the leader of this team, to enlighten us about how the 8 men were selected. Why were they divided into 2 teams, one for the front door, one for the back?
What was each man's role? What weapons did each cop have? Who made the decision not to ring the doorbell, but instead just go crashing in? How were the doors opened? Who opened them? Who were the first cops in? Who shot Spike, and why? Summerall cannot, or will not, answer most of my questions, and before long he's looking like an idiot. He was the commander, and proud of it, but on the stand, he's not sure of a lot of details. I hammer him for 2 hours and we take a break. Over a quick coffee, Doug tells me the jurors are skeptical and suspicious. A few seemed to be seething.
"We got him," he says,
but I caution him. Two of the jurors in particular worry me because they have ties to the police department, according to my old pal Nate Spurio. We met last night for a drink, and he says the cops are leaning on numbers 4 and 7. I'll deal with it later. I resist the urge to hound Summerall for the entire day, something I do more often than I should. There is an art to cross-examination, and quitting while you're ahead is part of the skill. I haven't learned it yet, because my instinct is to kick a brute like Summerall repeatedly when he's already down. Doug says wisely,
"I think you've done enough with this witness."
He's right, so I tell the judge I'm finished with Summerall. The next witness is Scott Kiesler, the cop who got shot, apparently by Doug Renfro. Finney takes him first on direct and tries his best to evoke some sympathy. The truth is, and I have all the medical reports, the bullet wound to his neck was only slightly more serious than superficial. In combat, he would have been given a couple of band-aids and sent back to the front. But the prosecution needs to score here, and Kiesler sounds like he took a bullet between the eyes. They drag this out far too long, and we finally break for lunch. When we're back in the courtroom, Finney says,
"No more questions, Your Honor."
"Mr. Rudd?"
At full volume, I pounce on Kiesler with,
"Officer, did you murder Kitty Renfro?"
Talk about sucking the air out of a room. Finney stumbles to his feet, objecting. Judge Ponder says,
"Mr. Rudd, if you—"
"We're talking about murder here, Judge, aren't we? Kitty Renfro was unarmed when someone shot and killed her in her own home. That's murder," Finney says loudly.
"It is not. We have a statute on this point. Peace officers are not liable."
"Maybe not liable," I interrupt, "but it's still murder." I wave my arms at the jury and demand,
"What else do you call it?"
3 or 4 actually nod affirmatively.
Judge Ponder says, "Please refrain from using the word murder, Mr. Rudd."
I take a deep breath. So does everyone else. Kiesler looks like a man facing a firing squad. I return to the podium, stare at him, and say politely, "Peace Officer Kiesler, on the night of this SWAT raid, what were you wearing?"
"I'm sorry?"
"What were you wearing, please? Tell the jury everything that was on your body." He swallows hard, then begins clicking off the armor, weaponry, and so on. It's a long list.
"Keep going," I say. He finishes with, "Boxer shorts, t-shirt, white athletic socks."
"Thank you. Is that all?"
"Yes."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
"Absolutely certain?"
"Yes, I'm certain."
I stare at him as though he's a filthy liar, then I walk to the exhibit table and pick up a large color photograph of Kiesler on a stretcher as he's being rushed into the ER. His face is clearly visible. Since the photo has already been introduced into evidence, I hand it to Kiesler and ask,
"That you?"
He looks at it, confused, says,
"That's me."
The judge allows me to pass the photo to the jurors. They take their time, absorb the image, then I take it back.
"Now, Peace Officer Kiesler, looking at you in this photograph, what is this black stuff you're wearing on your face?"
He smiles, relieved.
"Oh, shucks. Oh, that's just black camouflage paint."
"Also known as war paint?"
"I guess. It has several names."
"What's the purpose of war paint?"
"It's for camouflage purposes."
"So it's pretty important, huh?"
Sure is, yes.
It's necessary to ensure the safety of the men on the ground, right?
Absolutely.
How many of the 8 peace officers in your SWAT team that night covered their faces with black war paint?
I didn't count.
Did all of our peace officers wear black war paint that night? He knows the answer, and he figures I do too. He says,
I'm really not sure.
I walk to my table and pick up a thick deposition. I make sure he sees it. Now, Peace Officer Kiesler. Finney stands and says,
Now, Your Honor, I'll object here. He keeps using the term peace officer. I think that
you used it first, Judge Ponder fires back.
You used it first. Overruled.
We eventually establish that 4 of the cops decorated themselves with black war paint, and by the time I move on, Kiesler looks as dumb as a teenager playing with crayons. It's time for some real fun. I say, Now, Peace Officer Kiesler, you play a lot of video games, right? Finney is back on his feet.
Objection, Your Honor. Relevancy?
Overruled, His Honor says harshly, without even looking at the prosecutor. Judge Ponder has become increasingly and obviously fed up with the police and their lies and tactics. We have all the momentum, a rarity for me, and I'm not sure how to handle it. Do I speed things along and get the case to the jury while they're on our side? Or do I plod along, scoring every possible point? Scoring is so much fun. Plus, I have a hunch the jury is squarely on my side and enjoying this train wreck.
What are some of the video games you enjoy playing?
He names a few, benign, almost kiddie-like games that make him sound like an overgrown fifth grader. He and Finney know what's coming, and they're trying to soften the blow. In doing so, Kiesler looks even worse.
How old are you, Mr. Kiesler?
26, he says with a smile. Finally, an honest answer.
And you're still playing video games?
Well, yes, sir.
In fact, you've spent thousands of hours playing video games, right?
I guess.
And one of your favorites is Mortal Attack 3, right?
I'm holding his deposition, a thick sworn statement in which I managed to hammer out the fact that he got hooked on video games when he was a kid and still loves them.
I guess, yes, he says.
I wave his deposition like it's poison and say,
Well, haven't you already testified in a sworn deposition that you've been playing Mortal Attack 3 for the past 10 years?
Yes, sir.
I look at Judge Ponder and say, Your Honor, I would like to show the jury a clip from Mortal Attack 3. Finney is turning flips. We've been arguing about this for a month, with Ponder withholding a ruling until this very moment. Finally, he says,
I'm intrigued.
Let's take a look. Finney tosses a legal pad on his table in total frustration. Ponder growls,
Enough of the theatrics, Mr. Finney. Take a seat.
I rarely have the judge on my side, and I'm not sure how to act. The courtroom lights are dimmed while a screen drops from the ceiling. A tech guy has edited a 5-minute clip of the video game. At my instruction, he cranks up the volume, and the jury is jolted by the sudden image of a bulky soldier kicking in a door as explosions rip through the background. An animal resembling a dog, but with shining teeth and huge talons, lunges forward and our hero guns him down. Villains appear in doors and windows, and they're all blown to hell and back. Bullets, the kind you can see, blast and ricochet. Body parts are ripped off. Blood is knee-deep. People scream and shoot and die with great drama, and after 2 minutes, we've seen enough. After 5 minutes, the entire courtroom needs a break. The screen goes blank, and the lights come on. I glare at Kiesler, who's still on the witness stand, and say, All fun and games, right, Peace Officer Kiesler? He does not respond. I watch him drown for a few seconds, then say,
And you also enjoy playing a game called Home Invasion, right?
He shrugs, looks toward Finney for help, and finally grunts,
I guess.
Finney stands and says,
Judge, is this really relevant?
The judge is leaning on his elbows and ready for more. He says,
Oh, I think this is very relevant, Mr. Finney. Let's roll the tape.
The lights go down, and for 3 minutes we watch the same mindless mayhem and gore. If I caught Starcher playing this garbage, I'd lock him away in rehab. At one point, juror number 6 whispers loudly, "Good God!" I watch them as they stare at the screen, thoroughly disgusted. When the videos are over, I force Kiesler to admit that he also likes a game called Crack House Special Ops. He admits the cops have a locker room in the basement of the police department. Courtesy of the taxpayers, it is equipped with a 54-inch flat-screen television, and for fun, the boys gather there between SWAT maneuvers and play video game tournaments. Over Finney's lame objections, I drag this out of Kiesler bit by bit. By now, he doesn't want to talk about it, and this makes matters worse for him and the prosecution. When I finish with him, he is destroyed and discredited. As I sit down, I look at the gallery. The chief of police is gone, and for good. Judge Ponder asks, "Who's your next witness, Mr. Finney?" Finney has the hangdog look of a prosecutor who doesn't want to call any more witnesses. What he does want to do is catch the next train out of town. He looks at a notepad and says, "Officer Boyd." Boyd fired 7 rounds that night. At the age of 17, he was convicted of a DUI but managed to get his record expunged later. Finney doesn't know about the DUI, but I do. At the age of 20, Boyd received a dishonorable discharge from the Army. When he was 24, his girlfriend called 911 and complained of domestic abuse. Things were swept under the rug. No charges stuck. Boyd is also the veteran of 2 other botched SWAT raids, and he's enthralled with the same video games that keep Kiesler so occupied. Getting Boyd on cross-examination could well be the highlight of my legal career. Judge Ponder suddenly says, "We're going to recess until Monday morning at 9. I want to see the lawyers in my chambers." Chapter 22. As soon as the door closes, Judge Ponder glares at Finney and growls, "Your case sucks. The wrong person is on trial." Poor Finney knows it but cannot say so. In fact, at this moment he's unable to say anything at all. The judge hammers away. "Do you plan to put all 8 of the SWAT team on the witness stand?"
"As of now, the answer is no," Finney manages to say. I pounce with, "Great, then I'll call them as adverse witnesses. I want all 8 to face the jury." The judge looks at me fearfully. I have the absolute right to do this, and they know it.
Seconds pass as they try and imagine the nightmare of the other 6 toy soldiers facing the jury as I pound them like a madman. His Honor looks at Finney and asks, "Have you thought about dismissing the charges?" Of course not. Finney may be demoralized, but he's still a prosecutor. Normally, in a criminal trial, the judge has the right to exclude the state's evidence and direct a verdict in favor of the defendant. This rarely happens. In this case, though, the statute declares that any person who fires upon a policeman who is entering his or her home, whether the cops have the correct address or the wrong one, is guilty of the attempted murder of an officer. It's a bad statute, poorly conceived and dreadfully written, but in Judge Ponder's opinion, it does not afford him the option of dismissing the case. We're headed for a final verdict. Chapter 23. Over the weekend, one of the remaining 6 SWAT cops is suddenly hospitalized and cannot testify. One simply vanishes. It takes me a day and a half to annihilate the remaining 4. We're getting front-page coverage, and the police department has never, ever looked so bad. I'm trying my best to savor this glorious moment, because it's unlikely to happen again. On the last day of testimony, I meet the Renfro family for an early breakfast. The topic is whether or not Doug should testify. His 3 adult children, Thomas, Fiona, and Susanna, are present. They have watched the entire trial and have no doubt our jury will not convict their father, regardless of what some lousy statute says. I explain the worst-case scenario.
Finney will get under his skin on cross-examination and try to irritate him. He'll make Doug admit that he fired 5 shots from his handgun and deliberately tried to kill the officers. The only way the state can win the case is for Doug to melt down on the stand, something we simply do not expect. The guy is solid, and he insists on testifying. At this point in any trial, the defendant has the right to testify, regardless of what his lawyer thinks. They press me on this. My instincts are the same as any criminal defense attorney. If the state has failed to prove its case, keep the client off the stand. But Doug Renfro will not be denied. Chapter 24. I begin by asking Doug about his military career. 14 years in uniform, proudly serving his country, without a blemish. 2 tours in Vietnam, 1 Purple Heart, 2 weeks as a prisoner before being rescued. 6 medals, an honorable discharge. A real soldier, not the dime store variety. A law-abiding citizen with only 1 speeding ticket on his record. The contrasts are stark and speak for themselves. On the night in question, he and Kitty watched television until 10 o'clock, then read for a few minutes until they turned off the lights. He kissed her goodnight, told her he loved her as always, and they fell asleep. They were jolted from their dreams when the assault began. The house shook. Shots were fired. Doug scrambled for